Well, this morning, I think it's most important to really emphasize the most fundamental aspect of nutrition, which is nourishment. And it's really a lost art. It's one of the core principles to self-care. And unfortunately, there are so many different paradigms in this field that inhibit people from experiencing true nourishment. Most people live under the assumption throughout much of the world, although not all of the world, that humans are well nourished if they look to be of good size and they, you don't see all of their bones. And we think that in America, for instance, most doctors that I work with think that there's, you know, that malnourishment only exists in areas of the world where people have food shortages and very limited supplies. And that's just not the case. Malnourishment is so common that I would go as far as to say that most people that I see day in and day out have one form of malnourishment or another. And this is for several reasons. And it isn't just a malnourishment with respect to food. That's a very small part of it. Most people experience one form of malnourishment or another with respect to a malnourishment of nature, a malnourishment of love, a malnourishment of electrons, which we should be taking up from either plants or the Earth's surface or from water, a malnourishment of sunlight. These are all forms of malnourishment that are every bit essential to health, to wellness, to having the kind of experience that we all want. And in my studies, I predominantly focused on nutrients, a very small portion of nourishment, but the one that, you know, I tend to know the most about. But as I get older and I see more and more people, I realize that those other forms of nourishment are every bit as important, if not more important. And that maybe some of the nutrients we will discuss today and the rest of this week are very important, and I will emphasize them. They do not begin to compare to the most core or essential components, not just important for humans, but for all mammals. You know, touch, again, being in contact with nature and the earth, sunlight, these things really have an incredible ability to heal. So I want to make sure that we, you know, really look at nourishment on a broad level and not just with respect to what supplements you should take or which nutrients, you know, you may be in need of. And of course, those things are going to be important. But, you know, on a broader level, I look at how most people practice one form of nutrition or another, and it's become incredibly reductionistic. People look at nutrition with usually very, very intense lenses. So their understanding of nutrition is that, you know, maybe they are only supposed to eat paleolithic foods, or they're only supposed to eat plants, or they're only supposed to eat, you know, this way. And you know, that's, I think that can become somewhat dangerous because it puts people in a box or a prison for how they should live. And I was in that prison at one time in my career. I had been a very strict vegan for a time. I was in graduate school. I was learning all of these amazing things about plants and their ability to heal, and about all of the perils of a high-fat, high-cholesterol diet. And you know, it's in a way it was dogma, and it really kept me in a certain way of eating that may not have been as harmful to my health as another way, but it didn't serve me well. And then over time, I just saw so many other individuals that were following a particular belief system that may not have served them very well. And you know, again, as I mentioned last night, For me, the most rewarding part about this journey that I've been on is to look back and to smile as Simone encourages us to do, and to look at these really tightly held beliefs that I had around how I was supposed to eat, and not really giving myself a chance to step out of that dogma or belief system and to feel. And once I started to feel, and once I started to have a greater sense of appreciation for myself as a mammal, not as a graduate student who learned the Dean Ornish principles or, you know, the principles of a high fiber, low fat diet. Once I stepped out of that and I left myself really feel, and I started to go back to my roots as a child, which were growing up on a farm, and really seeing all of the commonalities between the animals on our farm and the animals that my father and I hunted in the woods, and that I observed anytime I went out into the woods. Once I started seeing myself more as a mammal and a creature living in a particular ecology, that's when it all started to click for me. That's when everything really started to make sense, and I started to, I think, develop a much deeper appreciation for the word nourishment. So what are some of the things that get in the way of the nourishment when we get beyond this paradigm that many of us live in? It's, you know, again, common things that we are told. You know, I'd say one of the most common ones that I hear are when people are told that, you know, they shouldn't eat too much. I find that very interesting. When someone is told not to eat too much and they're hungry, I feel like it's telling someone who has a cold, you know, don't sneeze, don't cough. Very similar. I think that the human body, if we are able to really slow down and listen to ourselves, we have an incredible gift, an innate gift with which we should listen and follow as to how much to eat and what to eat. But much of this, again, is overridden by very common messages that we are bombarded with day in and day out. And I always want to emphasize the importance of looking at yourself as one that is part of nature, that is yet another mammal. And if we look at the mammalian model, all mammals need very similar things, right? We're all warm-blooded. We all have hair. You know, there's just this list of commonalities that all mammals share. And the diet, which is a difficult word for me to say, but the diet or the food choices of mammals across the board are much more similar than they are different. And most people are surprised to hear that. Most people feel that mammals eat radically different diets. So if I were to say to you, what does a lion eat? And people say meat. And then if I were to say, what does a cow eat? And people say grass. And I'll say, okay, is that, you know, at first glance, without a deeper appreciation for the physiology of those two very different mammals, most people think, you know, how is this possible? Well, the cow converts the grass to fat. Not in the way it stores the grass in its body as fat, but the cow and all of the microbes that make that cow's digestive tract so incredible, the cow's digestive tract and the microbes, the bacteria that make that cow's microbiome so effective, convert all of that fiber in the grass to short-chain fatty acids, which the cow then absorbs as fat and utilizes for its energy needs, whether that be to feed the young calf, to provide milk, or to put on muscle. The lion eating meat is eating much less protein in the wild than it is fat. The lion, if left to a natural food selection, doesn't get filet mignon. It doesn't get these lean cuts of meat. The lion eats the fattiest, most nutrient-dense components of either the gazelle or the wildebeest. And the gazelle and the wildebeest, much like the cow, have eaten a very high-fat diet when you take into consideration that they have eaten grass. And grass isn't a great source of protein or carbohydrate or fat. Grass is mostly fiber with small amounts of the other things. And we can go on, I'm beyond that. Gorillas don't eat bananas in the wild. When you feed a gorilla bananas in the zoo, they die at a very, very young age. 75% of a gorilla's diet is made up of leaves, very, very high fiber components to the diet. And the gorilla's rumen is amazing at converting all of that fiber in those leaves to fat with which it absorbs. So the list goes on and on, but I think because I am, more than anything, I'm deeply appreciative of our understanding of biology and ecology and how we really have to see ourselves as being one, not different from that. But there's always an attempt to separate ourselves, right? It has gone on for so much of human history in one way or another, but all of the populations that I've spent time with in different areas of the world who have the human experience that I, you know, think all of us should embrace, they have always seen themselves as one with nature and have not created barriers with which they separate themselves from nature. And so when we talk about nourishment, and a few of us have already had these great conversations at breakfast or last night at dinner, I think it's very important to start with the most fundamental aspects of nourishment that should be seen as very natural. And one of those, of course, is sunlight. If you do not have adequate exposure to sunlight, there will be a certain amount of malnourishment. And most people say, oh, sure, that's vitamin D, but I'll take a vitamin D supplement. And it's not the same. Vitamin D supplements provide us with the next best thing, but they're not equivalent to what your body would manufacture when you were exposing your skin, unprotected by sunscreen or sunblock. That's very important to embrace. If you wear sunscreen or sunblock, this natural, most beautiful process will not take place. But it goes much further than vitamin D production. It starts to tap into one of those biochemical pathways that allow us to detoxify components of our diet and environmental exposures. It allows us to maintain a certain amount of our tissues to be water soluble, to be very supple. Too many humans who do not spend time in the sun, who do not eat nourishing foods, become very compartmentalized. Their bodies become made up of fat-soluble components and water-soluble components, and much like oil and vinegar, they start to separate, and they start to have a very difficult time at delivering nutrients to essential organs and to having proper circulation. And a lot of this revolves around a process known as sulfation. And I'm not sure if you've heard of sulfation before, but it's one of many biochemical processes that allow us to do incredible things and to adapt to radically different environments and to meet the challenges that, again, over the course of human history, we have always embraced and have been incredibly successful at thriving, not just surviving, but thriving in radically different environments, from the Arctic pole to equatorial regions with just immensely different pressures being placed on our physiology. Sulfation is a process that allows us to do that. And sulfation works like this. If your diet provides you with enough sulfur, and we'll get to the richest sources of sulfur in a while, but they would be things such as eggs. Having sulfur in your environment is more common if you live where there are volcanoes or volcanic material, because typically volcanic soil is very high in sulfur. But whether it's eggs or it be dairy products such as milk or cheese, or meats, especially organ meats like liver, and then of course your brassica vegetables, things like broccoli, bok choy, arugula, kale, all of these are decent sources of sulfur. And then others such as garlic and onions. These are across the board, from plants to animals, these are all decent sources of sulfur. When your body accumulates enough sulfur from your diet, or maybe from environmental intakes, again, living near or on the side of a volcano, then that sulfur is processed when you have exposure to sunlight. And again, this is a very, very important part of the process. The sunlight, along with microbes on the surface of your skin, start to drive this chemical reaction known as sulfation. And the sulfation affects various aspects of our physiology, but one of the most important is it makes the cholesterol in your skin a carrier of the sulfate molecule. And when cholesterol carries the sulfate molecule, it is now water soluble, so it travels very freely in the body. It doesn't have to be packaged in a very specific way by the liver into a lipoprotein, let's say. It can travel freely. It can be used by your immune system to help fight infection. It can help make your cell membranes more fluid and not too stiff or rigid. It's an absolute critical component to health is having sulfated cholesterol as opposed to a large pool of non-sulfated cholesterol, which doesn't move very freely in the body, requires great effort by the body to get it to where it can be helpful and not pathological in terms of causing disease. So sunlight is critical, and again, it goes much beyond vitamin D, but it is, I think, one of the most evidently missing aspects of nourishment, because people have been taught to run from the sun, whereas early human cultures worshipped the sun. And I try to fall more in line with the latter. You look at so many early human cultures that understood life could not exist without the sun, and if we tried to hide from it all the time, we can't grow plants without sunlight, and we ourselves can't be healthy without sunlight. So I think it's one of the things that Mark and I, you know, really emphasize in our teachings is that you have to embrace sunlight. And if you live in an area where sunlight is not always accessible, you have to take efforts to try to acquire the next best thing. And that isn't always an oral vitamin D. It may be the use of lights, therapeutic lights that can, while not the sun, can deliver you some of this chemical. They can act as a catalyst to help you with sulfation and as along the way to produce vitamin D. And if you are going to try to rely on food because you don't want to use one of these particular lights, the only source of sulfated vitamin D that we can acquire from food is from raw milk, not pasteurized milk, because it immediately destroys the sulfated form of vitamin D. But raw milk can provide us with a sulfated form of vitamin D. It's very, very unique. And then beyond that, it's, you're doing the next best thing by taking a vitamin D supplement, but you're not getting what ideally the human body would acquire. This is a radical concept because, again, most people are taught from a very young age to always wear sunscreen or sunblock, stay in the shade, that sun causes cancer. To me, that's it turns everything upside down. The sun does not cause life-threatening forms of cancer. It doesn't cause malignant melanoma. In fact, the opposite has been shown to be true. The sun is actually protective against malignant melanoma, and the sun is somewhat causative to skin damage from very, very high, intense, prolonged exposure. But the type of skin damage that is caused by the sun is not the type of cancer that metastasizes in the body. It's it's on surface only type of damage. The deep damage to the body is caused by spending prolonged periods of time behind glass and not getting out in the actual sunlight. But I think it's so important to look at the sun as a source of nourishment. And most people, if they let themselves let go of all the preconceived notion, all the dogma, and they go out in the sun and they lay with their eyes shut, they feel themselves starting to melt away. They feel relaxation. They feel their blood pressure drop. They feel at peace. And then, unfortunately, something clicks in their mind. Uh-oh, this isn't good. I'm in the sun. I'm burning. I'm increasing my risk for that or not. And they let go of that feeling that they had when they're in the sun. So, you know, I want to cover that first because I think it's every bit as fundamental as drinking water, breathing oxygen. Most people accept those things as prerequisites to health, but the sun is every bit as important. Does anyone have any questions on this? Sure. How much raw milk? You would probably need 1 to 2 quarts a day to get the very modest amount of sulfated vitamin D that could somewhat represent, 30 minutes of sun in a northern latitude as where you live in Minnesota. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I didn't tell them to be dairy free. I just said, sure, why did I advise Montagne Azul to be dairy free? I didn't advise it to be dairy free. But I think it's important to work with the local resources that are here. And raw milk is something that is not always available. And you'll hear more this week, starting tomorrow, for instance, that if you're not sure that the milk is raw, if you're not sure that it's from the right kind of cow or goat, I think it's better to forego it. So, you know, I think that what we have available here is wonderful, but I don't think people have to be dairy-free. I think they have to just be very particular with the type of dairy products they choose. What is the right cow? I guess we don't have to wait till tomorrow. It doesn't have to be a cow. It just depends where you live. I mean, a goat is always going to be representative of an animal that produces A2 casein or alpha-2 casein. A2 casein is very compatible with human physiology. The milk from a Brahma cow, which is common here in Costa Rica, is often very representative of an animal that would produce A2 casein. However, this is a very important however. Most cows that are being used for a larger scale production of milk have had the A1 casein gene introduced into its breed. Now, A1 casein is not compatible with human physiology, and I'll be quite honest. The reason that dairy products receive so much negative attention as being causative for cancer or causing arthritis or causing heart disease, the list goes on and on. People are told all the time, don't eat dairy, don't eat dairy. And people are told that, you know, they have a lactose intolerance, which is most often not the case. Dairy comes in 1,001 different shapes and forms. Raw milk from an A2 casein producing animal, sheep, goats, water buffaloes, okay? Yaks. I've spent so much time in Nepal and Tibet where, you know, people use yak milk daily. Camels, okay? But it is really a very unique thing that we have more often in the Western Hemisphere than in other areas of the world, where animals have been bred to produce large amounts of milk. Now, as soon as our priorities in agriculture become greater yield and not better quality or biocompatibility, we have problems. Malnourishment in many areas of the world is a function of the food industry or agriculture losing sight of what should be the primary goal of agriculture, which is to nourish populations. What we do is we feed populations, but we don't nourish them. We give people box cereals with more nutritional value in the cardboard box than in the cereal. We give populations large amounts of milk that are not compatible with their physiology because we have chosen to use the Holstein cow. Are you familiar with the Holstein cow? Yeah, they're black and white. Holstein cows, yeah. So that's a cow that produces 3,500 gallons of milk in a 300-day milking cycle. That's very different than what our ancestors would have chosen to feed their families 2,000, 3,000 years ago. Is dairy for everybody? Probably not. But dairy is not the across the board. It's not the cause of disease that so much of mainstream literature makes it out to be. Now, if you were to go to the grocery store and buy a carton of milk that's been pasteurized and homogenized and is from a Holstein cow, I wouldn't want anybody to drink that. And that I unequivocally state. But if you were to find the raw milk from a Guernsey or a Brahma cow, okay, that was all A2. And I can tell you how you can find this out. All you need is a hair sample from the animal, and you send it to a lab, and they'll tell you within 2 weeks what the genetics of that cow are. Now, not everybody has to do that. But if you really wanted to have some raw milk in your diet, or you wanted to make your own raw yogurt, which we'll teach you how to make, I think it's maybe worthwhile. But you can always rely on goat milk. It's always A2, and I think it's a really safe choice across the board. So usually we don't get into raw milk until day 3 or 4, but that's okay. Yeah. Well, I wouldn't want to lead anybody to believe that a pasteurized goat milk would be as good as raw. Raw milk is always the best. There are substances in raw milk that you will not find in a pasteurized or homogenized carton. So I think raw milk is the way to go. If you don't want to have raw milk, then I think you should take a pasteurized goat milk and make yogurt out of it, or kefir. Because the microbes will really transform that into something that's much more compatible with you. Yeah. Okay. Yes. What's an alternative light source to the sun? Again, probably not as powerful as sunlight, but you can now find what are called sun lamps that produce ultraviolet light type B. That's what's necessary. UVB is what's necessary to help the body manufacture vitamin D in the skin from cholesterol. Your body makes vitamin D from cholesterol. Cholesterol is our greatest friend, just like the sun. And again, equally shocking to me as the paradigm that we live in, which is to run from the sun, we have in our medical world now an attempt to lower everybody's cholesterol levels, as opposed to saying to the individual, how can we change your cholesterol to something that's working for you and not against you? That has to be the new model. I say to people who have very high cholesterol levels of 300 milligrams per deciliter, I say, don't look at that as a risk factor. Look at that as something you can really work with. You want your cholesterol to be greater than 200, not under 200. Statins are devastating to human physiology, especially at the dosages that they are often recommended for interventionally to really drive cholesterol under 180. No, what you want to do is you want to sulfate your cholesterol by getting out in the sunlight, making it water soluble, and giving your body a great pool with which your immune system can use that can carry sulfate to other areas of the body where it can have very profound antioxidant-like effects. So you have these sun lamps that are available made by companies such as Spurti. And we can, you know, Mark and I can speak more to this later. But you have some pretty good choices now. Yeah, that'd be great.
So we're trying to record some of this and have a very short leash here. And we're going to talk more about other light sources. If you look at an incandescent light bulb, it much more closely approximates the full spectrum of light that you get with sunshine. And you're all familiar with the spectrum, that beautiful rainbow of colors that goes from violet and blue, which is higher energy color light, to the red end of the spectrum. And sunlight even gives us infrared, which is a powerful, powerful source from a health and healing perspective. I've got a lot of information that I'll share a little bit later in the week on that, but it's really important. So an incandescent bulb is a much better approximation of natural light than what, certainly in America and I suspect all over the world now, these fluorescent bulbs, these compact fluorescent bulbs are really problematic. They don't use as much energy, and from an energy conservation perspective, that, you know, that's a plus. But if you look at the light quality, compact fluorescent bulbs are mostly blue light. And mercury is what is vaporized to produce the light that comes from a compact fluorescent bulb. So it's a double whammy. You're getting mostly blue light, very little orange, yellow, red. And the source of that light is mercury. So there are probably many aspects of mercury exposure that are problematic. The other types of bulbs that would be a huge upgrade from compact fluorescent would be halogen light, halogen bulbs. They also very much approximate sunshine. Then there are specific lights, and John mentioned one in particular, that has just the UVB, the vitamin D producing light. And I'll share some of this with you, but the most widely researched source is called SPERTI, S-P-E-R-T-I. A researcher at Boston University named Michael Hollick, who I think is one of the nation's, and maybe one of the world's experts on the relationship between light, vitamin D, and health, and did a lot of the research that totally shattered the paradigm that sunlight is dangerous. There is a complete and total inverse relationship. More sun, less cancer. Across the board. Not only true for melanoma, people that work outdoors have a much lower risk of melanoma. I mean, go figure, right? But if you look at breast cancer, women who have more sun exposure during their childhood and adolescent years have a much lower risk of breast cancer as they get older. And these aren't subtle effects. This is 60%, 70%, 80% reduction in risk over a lifetime on the basis of the quality of sunlight. So I love, John, that you chose light as a place to start this discussion around nourishment. Because what you'll see over the course of the week, and what I'm already sensing here at La Montaña Azul, is this amazing connection to nature. And John and I both have an ancestral way of looking at health. And one of the things that I'll share with you this afternoon is that the single greatest reason why we are becoming sick, and we're living longer than we did at the turn of the 20th century, the average life expectancy in the United States was 48. In 1900, the average life expectancy was 48. In 2017, the average life expectancy is about 78 to 80. Dramatic increase in how long we live. At the same time, we're seeing more chronic complex disease than ever. More diabetes, more depression, more Alzheimer's disease, more cancer, more heart disease, more ADD, more ADHD, more allergies, life-threatening allergies. You can eat a peanut now and be dead in 5 minutes. That is an abnormal response to a substance that historically people could consume without worrying about their health. And one of the single greatest drivers is the fact that our environment is less compatible with our biology. John talks about biologic compatibility. I love that. So light, to bring it back to light, one of the great changes in our disconnect from who we are, as we have lost touch with our entrainment, our synchronicity with sunrise and sunset. And when you look at the colors, the energy, Nikola Tesla, right, one of the great minds ever, said to understand the universe, you have to think about it in terms of energy, vibration, light. We've become disconnected from that, and I think it's very clear that it's one of the many reasons why human beings are sicker as they get older. We're deprived of natural light, and we have substituted that natural light with poor quality fluorescent, compact fluorescent indoor lighting. A candle is a healthier light source than a compact fluorescent bulb. So I think it really nicely sets the stage for how health is very much a byproduct of the alignment with the quality of one's environment, with the biology with which that organism, humans, is used to being in relationship with. And so, sorry to interrupt your flow, John. And we'll talk a lot more about alternative light sources. Yeah, Marianne.
This is premature, but just two super practical
questions. Yes. Yeah.
What do you guys
Yeah.
This program was supposed to be nude.
Yeah.
I couldn't quite get that.
Yeah, so there are two questions there, and and I will address. So what will I be doing this afternoon? I have to contact the hospital where I work. So I'll try to do that outdoors if I can, to tie up some loose ends. Ordinarily, the sun will be more intense, right? And I do think that there's a dose response that one needs to be mindful of, and I think many ancestral cultures adapted in a way that they would seek shade during the more intense aspects of the day. So I try to get as much sunlight as I can, short of burning. The dose of sun exposure as it relates to vitamin D, which is very much of just one marker, will be more intense. You can make about 20,000 units of vitamin D in 30 minutes during those peak hours. You'll make a little bit less earlier in the day and later in the day. If you wanted to get maximum benefit from sunshine at a lower dose, getting that between the hours of, say, 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. would be a more efficient way to leverage sunlight exposure. And I forgot your second question, Marianne. I'm sorry. Oh, about biomarkers. I think we'll talk more about this. Usually, how many of you have had your vitamin D levels measured? So most of you, which is awesome. You know, there's a lot of criticism of that. There are people who think that we're too obsessed with vitamin D and that we're wasting our time measuring levels. What we measure is called 25-hydroxy vitamin D. And like most things in healthcare and science, I don't know that it's the perfect marker. The most active, physiologic active form of vitamin D is 1,25-hydroxy. But it has a very short half-life, and it fluctuates wildly so that... measuring it doesn't always give you an accurate sense of where you are at in terms of your vitamin D, which is why we use the 25-hydroxy vitamin D. What we don't know is that some people won't absorb it as well. 25-hydroxy can quickly be converted to that 1,25, the active form. Some people do that extraordinarily well. So they may have a lower 25-hydroxy vitamin D, but it's not a problem because they're more rapid converters. So I don't think we yet know how to fully interpret it. What is clear is that a low 25-hydroxy vitamin D, and low would be perhaps less than 30, the units that we're used to are nanograms per ml. Once you start getting below 30 nanograms per ml, there is a higher risk of just about every chronic complex disease. The correlations are too powerful not to have some cause and effect. Once you get up above 30, and there's probably a sweet spot as there is for everything in nature, and right now that sweet spot would be between 30 and perhaps 60, you do seem to see dramatic risk reduction. But I think over time, over the next 10 years, we're going to find better markers that reflect quality of sunlight exposure beyond just vitamin 25-hydroxy vitamin D. Do you have any other thoughts on that, John?
Yeah, sure. I think when you take a look at vitamin D as a surrogate marker for sun exposure and for risk, I think there's, as Mark said, I think we're going to be approaching a time when the 125 form, which is more transient but is more reflective of activity, is going to be used in combination with a 25. So there's going to be some kind of equation where each number has a certain amount of weight in a mathematical equation that would give a better prediction of where someone's been. But to Mark's point, it's very interesting to look at free living populations who are out in the sun. They normally have ranges between 40 and 50. So if we were going to use that as a kind of a way or an assessment tool, whether you're looking at populations living in areas of equatorial Africa, Asia, Central America, South America, populations in the sun who have enough exposure usually have that 40 to 50 mark. That's, for many, that's considered to be kind of the target. But then people like Michael Hollick that Mark mentioned, he can very convincingly show you how a woman's risk of developing breast cancer drops. If she were to go from 32 to 50 in terms of her level of vitamin D, there's like an 80% risk reduction in breast cancer. So, I always tell people to aim for 50, and if it's 45, I think that's good as well.
And then the last thing I would just add before I hand this back to John is measuring 25-hydroxy vitamin D does not tell you what is sulfated and what isn't. The point that John made about sulfation is a unique biologic byproduct of vitamin D that is made from sun exposure. So when you're looking at levels of 40 to 50 in ancestral cultures, that is all sulfated vitamin D. You cannot tell by looking at just the blood level whether that is sulfated or not, which is why a vitamin D lamp is probably superior to taking a vitamin D supplement. That research has not been done, but I think at least conceptually that would be the case. Yes.
That's correct.
Yeah.
There's no alternative to the sun. The next best thing is the Spurdy lamp that Mark referred to.
Yeah, and that question was with respect to sulfation. Sunshine is the only way you can sulfate effectively. Yes. Yeah. Great question. So the question was with respect, is there one part of the body that is better to expose than another? And so if you look at skin as just a large, humans are large photoreceptors. And I think any skin that is exposed will effectively convert. I'm unaware that conversion is any more effective on the arms as opposed to one's back, for example. So generally what I'm recommending is that a person be as exposed as they comfortably can to maximize their surface area, understanding that in some latitudes you're not going to get much vitamin D. John and I live at a very northern latitude. And if you look at many chronic complex diseases, they're of much greater prevalence at more northern latitudes, whether it's cancer, whether it's multiple sclerosis, whether it's other autoimmune diseases, there's a much higher prevalence as you get to more northern latitudes. How much of that is vitamin D driven because of a relative lack of sunlight exposure, I think is unclear. There may be other attributes there, but I think there's a definite connection, which is why vitamin D, I think, in those populations is extremely important. And if you don't have a light source, an artificial light source for that, then I think taking a supplement, as John alluded to, would be your next best option.
Why is
Yeah, so the question is, what does vitamin D do and why is it's so important? And I'm going to let John answer that. It's an awesome question. And I think John will suggest that vitamin D is much more than just a vitamin.
Thanks. It is a hormone, yeah. And by definition, what makes a substance a hormone? First of all, if it's manufactured in the body, manufactured from cholesterol, which it is, and this is the most important thing, and I think gives us the deepest sense of appreciation for the power of vitamin D, again, ideally from the sun, there is a receptor for vitamin D on every single tissue in the human body. The brain, the kidneys, reproductive organs, even our white blood cells, the core of our immune system contains receptors for vitamin D. Now, this can take us down a rabbit hole very quickly, and I don't want to go there quite yet. We will, I promise. When it comes to cancer, the links that Mark was referring to that have been observed, there's a linear relationship for many cancers. The further you get from the equator, the higher your risk for, again, certain autoimmune diseases. But cancer, it's unbelievable. And this may be the link. The receptors on our white blood cells, which are called VDR, they're vitamin D receptors, and there's an array of them. And you can find out more about your particular vitamin D receptors, their activity, their concentrations with a genetic analysis. It's very interesting. For those of you who are familiar with 23andMe, you can learn a lot about your vitamin D receptors. There's some pretty good evidence now that the combination of a low vitamin D receptor activity on your white blood cells combined with low levels of vitamin D because you're not out in the sun is a perfect storm for cancer. So again, it's a hormone. That's what makes it so powerful. And I think the most fundamental thing to understand about vitamin D as a hormone, one of the things it does is it controls the rate of cellular division. As your vitamin D levels go higher, as you are out in the sun more, it actually slows down the process of cell division, which is fundamental to a component of health. So it's just so powerful as a hormone. And I'd feel very badly if I failed to mention this. You never want to take a vitamin D2 supplement, which is known as ergocalciferol. That's vitamin D2. You only want to take vitamin D3. There is some opposition to vitamin D3 by many of my good friends who are vegans because vitamin D3 is made from lanolin, from sheep's wool. So it is a byproduct of shearing sheep and then making, you know, lanolin from that. But the research on... What's that? It's not vegan. Vitamin D2 is typically made by bacteria or mushrooms. Vitamin D2 is very different. And I would say the meta-analyses in research which look at vitamin D2 supplementation are suspect, right, Mark? In terms of probably not good for the outcomes we want. You compare vitamin D2 to people who take nothing at all, and they're at more risk than if they didn't take anything. As opposed to those who take vitamin D3 get at least modest protection to sometimes very significant protection. So if you're going to take a vitamin D2 supplement, a vitamin D supplement, do not take a D2. Take a vitamin D3 supplement, and it's best if it's in oil. But I would encourage everybody to try to find a way to get to getting sunlight or to using a lamp. Yes. Portland, Oregon in the West Coast and Norfolk, Virginia or Richmond, Virginia in on the East Coast. You're fine. You're fine, yeah.
Here's my thing. If in fact I was going to use a lamp, mm-hmm. and you've mentioned that, and I think both of you have mentioned using one, like for me, to get me to do that, I would need some really specific directions.
They come with a box. That's the great part. The directions come with a box. You never want to be more than 12 inches. You want to be 12 inches away from the lamp, not much more than that. And they're going to tell you to do 3 to 5 minutes. I usually do 5 minutes on each side every day. 5 minutes in the front, 5 minutes on the back every day. But they're going to probably tell you 3 to 5 minutes because they don't know your skin type and whether you're going to burn or not and things like that. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
What about polluted cities like Mexico City, exposure to the sun?
Yeah.
How could that be this?
Smog and that kind of pollution can greatly interfere with vitamin D production. That's a very good question. It's a very important factor. It would take significantly greater amounts of time if there were a thick layer of smog, as there are in many cities. We have an epidemic in inner cities in America where African-American children are not, first of all, need much more sunlight than someone who would be Caucasian and have less melanin. Melanin is the X factor. The more melanin you have in your skin, the more vitamin D or sunlight you need to produce vitamin D. So, you know, earlier someone asked Mark a question about the best surfaces of the body to expose. There's really good evidence that as we get older, it becomes harder and harder for us to produce vitamin D with the equivalent amount of time because some of our skin accumulates melanin with prolonged exposure. So, you know, many people in their 60s or 70s start to develop sunspots. These concentrated areas of melanin, yeah. And I mean, you know, you can look at it two ways. I think it's good evidence that you're getting out in the sun, but it means you need a little more sun. That's all, because a little on those surfaces of your body, right? So if you had lots of sunspots on your shoulders or the backs of your arms or hands, you know, those surfaces would not quite, they wouldn't be as effective at generating vitamin D because they've built up a natural resistance to sunlight. So, you know, I think that when you're talking about smog or you're talking about the amount of melanin in an individual skin, these are all variables to this equation, which is how much time do we need? I tell people, and you know, a lot of times, especially dermatologists, they are really upset when they hear this recommendation. I tell people, get an hour of sun a day. Yeah, an hour a day. 15 minutes isn't enough. Even with the melanin, an hour is going to allow for significant production. Okay, that's why I say an hour, because it's across the board. There are people with an hour will burn them, right? There are people very fair skinned, and they go for an hour, especially in, you know, more equatorial regions. So they have to be smart and say, well, I don't maybe need a whole hour. But where we're from, okay, in the Northeast, people need an hour because the sun isn't as intense. So I tell people an hour a day. You may need more than an hour, but here in Costa Rica, I doubt it. I doubt. If the smog is very... At the beach, yeah. I think an hour at the beach, unprotected skin, I think that's excellent. Yeah, maybe 9 and 3 at the beach in Mexico. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're still going to have some pretty decent UVB transmission through the clouds. The clouds are different than smog. Smog is made up of a variety of particulates, and it acts as a natural sunscreen. But when it comes to clouds, it is not as significant as if it were a clear sky, but there's still some. Absolutely. Yeah. No, I don't agree with an RDA. Of 800 to 1,000 IUs? Yeah, no, I don't think that's adequate. You know, again, they could make an argument if that were all. Do I agree with the U.S. RDA or DRI? These are the recommended daily allowances or dietary reference intakes of.
None of
them. I don't agree with many of them. Yeah, most of them are either not well established or are their best guesses. But I don't think that's adequate. If someone's going to take vitamin D because they live in northern Minnesota, right, and there's no sun for a big part of the year, and they're not going to use a light box, you know, I think they would be more in line to take 5,000. They'd be better off with multiple thousand IUs than 800 to 1,000 IUs. I don't think that's adequate, except for young children. I don't know if you're worried about it. I'm not worried.
I mean, I certainly have been one of these people, and I have sheltered myself.
Uh-huh, yeah. Well, sure, that's understandable.
My child did, interestingly. I used to
Mm-hmm.
And then I, you know, convert it over to tanning. But I don't know, lots of sunspots and stuff, so we're just rolling with it.
I would roll with it.
You know, there are trade-offs. You will see some breakdown of collagen and damage to skin, and we are living longer, so the area under the curve of exposure is one that may predispose some wrinkling of the skin and loss of that integrity. I would see that as a trade-off. Now, one aspect of skin from a health perspective is with vitamin D, we're talking about UVB, ultraviolet light. On the infrared end of the light spectrum, and if you're into the sort of the biology, that's the frequency of light that gets up above 600 nanometers. Sunshine provides that all day long, provides more of it toward the end of the day, past that peak exposure, 2 in the afternoon. And so the red infrared can be very protective of the skin damage from the ultraviolet light. So sun exposure gives you both. If you're concerned about skin damage, which is a byproduct for sure, then there are red and infrared sources of light, much like a UVB source, that can produce what infrared light does is it enhances collagen production. This is nature's way of giving us collagen. You can begin to play with light from an interventional perspective in a way that might offset the extent to which longer-term UVB exposure is going to put your skin at risk of aging, which is a byproduct, to some extent an inevitable byproduct of that exposure. I think from a survival perspective, most of our ancestors would have taken the longevity and the risk reduction of chronic complex disease over the aging effects of the skin. But I do think with infrared light, and I'll talk a little bit more about this later in the week, there are infrared saunas. Much in the same way that you can get a UVB lamp, you can get light sources, LED or incandescent light sources that are red, a red incandescent light bulb toward the end of the day can be really soothing. It enhances melatonin production, helps with sleep, and it's really good for the skin. So there are light strategies to offset some of the accelerated aging that you can see. Yep.
And much in a similar fashion as we discussed, the similarity between us and all other mammals, many people are shocked to learn about the similarities between ourselves and plants. So are you familiar with photosynthesis? Right, the photoblasts in plants, which are, again, made up of chlorophyll and magnesium and all of these aspects that we can get into later, they, of course, receive the sun's energy and amazing things happen. Your mitochondria, which are highly concentrated in every cell, have very similar responses to sunlight, which, believe it or not, penetrates 2 to 3 centimeters below your skin surface. And when you start to think about the volume, when you take the skin surface, the largest organ in the body, and you think about 2 to 3 centimeters deep, encompassing your entire body, all of the mitochondria, I'm not sure if you're familiar with these, but these tiny organelles receive that infrared light that Mark just referred to and other components of the spectrum, and it's resuscitative. It helps those mitochondria be younger in a very, very similar fashion to how the photoblasts in plants help a plant produce protective substances and, again, be incredibly resilient. Your mitochondria have a requirement for this therapy. They have to have it, or else we, as a organism, right? As a sum of all these parts, we start to break down. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. In every single cell in your body. But think about all the red blood cells that flow close to the surface of your skin. Think about all of your tissues that are 2 to 3 centimeters below the surface of your skin. All of that tissue receives this, what we call phototherapy. And there's even some evidence, some people would want to dispute this, but there is evidence, and I've talked to some people that are fairly well-versed in the area of immunology. If you take your glasses off and you go out, you can even shut your eyes and do this, and you look up towards the sun with your eyes closed, of course, you don't want to stare at the sun with open eyes. As this infrared light penetrates your eyelid and reaches thousands and thousands of miles of tiny blood vessels that are at the back of the eye, it has very strong immune-supporting, antiviral, antimicrobial properties. And many people say that tuberculosis treatments were not a function of vitamin D, sending people from areas of, whether it's Boston or New York City, right? People were sent who had tuberculosis to Arizona, to New Mexico, and they said, well, it must have been the vitamin D. Many people feel it had much more to do with this as an effective component of treating that very otherwise untreatable disease. Again, going back, you know, a century or two. There's so much we don't know still about the power of the sun. There's so much we don't know. This is probably just scratching the surface. But to me, at this point in my career, and working with people over the last 20 plus years, I'll tell you what, as Mark just said, whether you're talking about this from an ancestral perspective or a very contemporary one, if I had to choose between diabetes, life-threatening forms of cancer, you know, the list goes on, a stronger immune system, a better outlook on life, having a really positive, you know, excited approach to life, as opposed, and then having skin that wasn't damaged, no skin spots, or having skin that looked like I was half my age, but kind of feeling really bad and depressed, I'm going to take the sun damage with kind of the, I think, the better overall perspective on life. Yeah.